Hello, and a warm welcome to the Reform Party podcast. Today I have a very special guest, Mr. Mark Littlewood. Mark is formerly the Director General of the Institute of Economic Affairs and was so for about 15 years, and is currently the Director of Popular Conservatism. So, a very warm welcome, Mark.
Okay.
Well, we met, as you know, a few weeks ago, when very briefly, at the Reform Party conference. What were your overall impressions of the conference?
I was pretty impressed by it. I suppose I've only got 2 points of comparator, that I've been to a lot of Conservative Party conferences, so I can compare it to that over the years. But probably the better point of comparison was I've been to a couple of UKIP conferences back in the day. I think there was one at Westminster Central Hall in about 2015, and one at Doncaster Racecourses back in, I think, 2014. I may be out a little by the years. And, I suppose one could see Reform as the kind of successor party to UKIP and the Brexit Party. And my impression is that it is a completely different beast to either of those two parties in terms of its size, scale, level of professionalism and impact. And I suppose none of that should come as a surprise because, at least as far as I recall, the Brexit Party and UKIP never managed to build a commanding lead in the opinion polls for months on end. So something's happening here that's rather different. I would say that my feel of the people who were in attendance was that these were... I didn't do any surveys, but my anecdotal impression was that these were ordinary folk who felt they needed to do something to save Britain. So I was pretty impressed. I thought there was quite an interesting distinction. I didn't spend more than about a few seconds in the main auditorium. That the main auditorium at Reform Conference seemed to be the glitz and the glamour and the firework displays and Andrea Jenkins singing songs in a sequin outfit, and I haven't got anything against any of that.
David Starkey didn't like it at all, he was telling me.
Right, yeah, but the more thinking, almost the more political or certainly policy orientated part was in the fringe meetings, and I hope that's a part that Reform build on next year. No problem for the main stage to basically be a rally. And I think previously Reform conferences and indeed conferences of UKIP and the Brexit Party were basically rallies more than conferring. It was more turning up and cheering on the leading lights. But I was pleased that there was substantial space and room made for serious in-depth policy debate. And if Reform wants to aspire to form a government at some point in the future, I think that part of its schedule will have to widen rather than shrink.
Yeah, I'm not at all keen on the razzmatazz, rah-rah-rah stuff either, I must say. And I spent most of my time in the fringe meetings rather than in the main hall. Mm-hmm. And I think there are a lot of people like that. I know from my work in the branch and so on, there are a lot of very serious reform supporters and intelligent people.
Yes, I think that's right. Look, I mean, it's horses for courses, isn't it? The purpose of party conferences is in part to rally the troops. All parties attempt to do that. So you want good optics for the, television cameras and all of the rest of it, and good photos in the newspapers the next day. I get all of that. That matters in terms of the PR for any political party. But I think I detect there's an appetite in Reform, not just to campaign, which is obviously the meat and drink of any political party, but to actually work through what needs to be fixed in Britain that goes beyond, let's elect a Reform government and take it from there, to try and work out this side of a general election, what actually needs to be fixed and corrected. And that level of cerebral work, I think, needs to go alongside all of the campaigning and all of the razzmatazz and all of the attention-grabbing stuff, all of which is obviously vital for a political party to win. So I'm not poo-pooing it. Rather, like you, Ken, it's probably not my cup of char as much as the policy debate, but that matters. But what matters, I think, now for Reform UK the most is mapping out what would it actually do. And the party's got a choice. I think it's made its decision, but nevertheless, it's got a choice of either being a kind of rail against the world protest machine. And my God, there's enough to rail against. So being that depository for protest might even be enough to win an election in terms of pointing everything that's going wrong and screaming about it. Or it segues into actually developing a coherent, sensible policy platform and narrative about what it would put right if the party gets a chance after the next election to actually form a government.
Yeah, I mean, I said we have some smart people I know within Reform, but we do need the intellectual heft from people like yourself and David and others to bring the policy framework together. Now, mm-hmm. we just managed to snaffle Danny Kruger, who's been made head of implementation mm-hmm. of our election programme. How do you think he'll do?
As we're speaking, I had a meeting with him actually to discuss how he was going about his work. I think he's approaching it methodically and in the right way. It seems to me that you've got basically Zia Yusuf is in terms of the bread and butter policy. You know, what taxes might be cut by what amount, how government departments might have different priorities, but that Danny Kruger's job is to write the playbook, I guess you would call it, that there needs to be some sort of manual or set of directions that will be reached for at sort of 4 o'clock on the Friday morning after polling day were Reform to form a government. And you lock it away in a safe somewhere, although obviously large parts of it would appear, one presumes, in the Reform manifesto. But it takes one through the sequencing of what you need to do in hour one, day one, week one, the first 100 days. What's the low-hanging fruit that you might be able to quickly pluck? What's the higher-hanging fruit and how will you get to it? That's an enormous task. And look, it's a completely irrelevant one if Reform don't win the election. But were Reform to form the next government, it's the absolutely vital task. So I hope Danny's a good campaigner and, you know, excellent on the media and all the rest of it, and I'm sure he'll be deployed for that as well. But it seems to me that the missing feature of so many governments of whatever political stripe, so I'm not making an ideological point here, is that they've entered government without a clearly worked out plan. I mean, that's certainly true of Keir Starmer. I think if he did have a clearly worked out plan, I wouldn't much like it. But nevertheless, they seem to just be trying to form a government and say, well, let's take it from here. We'll sort of make it up as we go along. It's absolutely vital that if whatever government we face after 2029, assuming it's a change from this one, that isn't the position, that there's a clear, sequenced, workable, outable plan of what's going to be legislated first, what's going to be altered first, what changes are going to be made to government departments, what changes are going to be made to the civil service, to the judiciary, is there going to be an emergency budget, all of are there going to be changes to the House of Lords, all of that needs to be worked out. I think it would be too much to hope that the book would be a kind of gospel that every single page would follow sequentially and you'd never deviate from it, because in the real world, events intervene. But nevertheless, you need a kind of blueprint, roadmap, which, you know, is how you would roll out what you would do and in what order. So it's not just a list of policy pledges. It's, you know, what has to happen first? What has to happen second? What is perhaps what do you perhaps wait a year or two before you tackle? You don't necessarily want to be tackling everything on all fronts at once. I think Danny Kruger's a very impressive bloke, just the sort of person that Reform UK needs to be appealing to if they're serious about forming a government. And, you know, as a patriot, I wish him well in his task. And if there's anything that I or others can contribute to his thinking, I'll happily do that. If the next government doesn't succeed, I really fear for British democracy, actually, because we had 14 years of the Conservatives, all right, under various different guises and five different leaders over that period of time. But the British electorate, entirely understandably, reached the conclusion in July 2024, we've just got to get rid of the Tories, they're useless. So they went for a change of management. They've fallen out of love with the Labour Party at record pace. Looks like they'll be at least as determined at the next election to kick out the Labour Party. And it might be now that the British people don't just want a change of management, but they want a change of system. that just shuffling around who's the captain of the ship isn't worth changing if the ship's heading to the rocks. So were that to happen, and were there to be some reform-led sort of government, if that doesn't work as well, I think we are, as they say, not in Kansas anymore, as they say in The Wizard of Oz. That could be an incredibly dangerous time if a new incoming government doesn't get it right, and the Conservatives and Labour are pretty much reviled or ignored by large chunks of the country, then democracy itself is in peril. So there's a huge amount at stake at the next election, and there's a vast amount that needs to be done, all of it in parallel, not in sequence, because I know some people think there's going to be an early election. I still think that's unlikely. But even if we go right the way through to the spring or summer of 2029, those weeks and months will disappear in a flash. We'll be in the early stages of a general election before we know it.
Yeah, I mean, the difficulty with having a too detailed a roadmap of where we're going to go is it's very difficult to anticipate what kind of resistance we're going to experience. And you may say, you know, okay, we'll have David's restoration policy, and we'll one act we will repeal the Constitutional Reform Act, the Equality Act, and go through all of them all. But what you don't know is how that's possible. That's going to be to do how much resistance you're going to get from the civil service, from the establishment to making these changes, and so therefore you have to be flexible with the roadmap, is what I'm saying.
Yeah, maybe. But I think you can anticipate the scale of resistance that would face. And I think you can assume that the resistance will be monumental. Mm. There will be efforts by the establishment and the blob to legally infract virtually anything a reform government were to attempt to do. That the civil service will be at best unenthusiastic about the programme of a reform government, and at worst would have individuals within it who would be seeking to completely undermine it. That resistance would be pretty high from the House of Lords, from the Supreme Court. I think that the best working assumption is that resistance from the political establishment will be almost totally universal and enormous, and that the playbook should reflect that, rather than let's get into power and then work out whether we think the House of Lords is likely to be a problem. So, you know, a decision needs to be made. For example, I'm not saying that this is one of the top priorities, but a decision needs to be made on whether a reform government would flood the House of Lords, let's say create 500, 600, 700 new peers almost immediately to reflect the will of the country if reform had won a government, or whether you want to reform the House of Lords, remove a certain chunk.
There is a third option. We could get rid of it.
Yes, you could. You could. So, I mean, I put that as the most extreme thing you can do within a reform category. So, do you keep the basic structure as it is and put loads of reformers in there, or do you change the structure or get rid of it? Big decision. No obviously right answer. Needs to be gamed, needs to be scenario planned. And I think you're right, Ken, that you can't perfectly anticipate each and every unfolding thing that's going to occur when one's in government. Of course not. The future, making predictions is extremely difficult, especially about the future, as they say. But you can assume the sort of resistance that's likely to be found and not find yourself a month into government thinking, well, are we going to scrap the House of Lords, or are we going to reform the House of Lords, or are we going to face it down and use the Parliament Act? All of that needs to be red teamed, stress tested long in advance of the formation of a government. Doesn't mean you need to stick to the letter of whatever playbook emerges, but you certainly need to have one.
Yeah, but just take that one simple example. There's a huge amount of work needing to be done on that before we hopefully take power. If we were to decide that we did want to get rid of the House of Lords and replace it with a second chamber, we have to do all the work in terms of what that second chamber would look like, who would be in it. There's a huge amount of work. I don't think we should be shying away from that. We should be starting work on that now, in my view.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I suppose that the happy news for reform supporters is that you seem to be doing just that, right? policies are being rolled out by Reform. My humble observation would be, I'm not sure they're being stress tested quite enough before they're being put in the public domain. So I think they're being worked out. The sort of the headline grabbing elements of them are being worked out. But I think it might be useful to stress test them a bit more. I'm thinking in particular about the recent policy announcements on ending indefinite leave to remain and who would be able to stay here. And does that include EU citizens of settled status? To my mind, I understand the need for speed, but potentially that came out of the traps a little bit too fast. Could have done with a bit some more stress testing. But that's happening. Policy development is occurring. I think Danny Kruger's unit, department, work stream, whatever you want to call it, you know, is getting underway. But this is the real heavy lifting that most people involved in politics think, quite understandably and not wholly wrongly, in terms of the electoral cycle and who's running for local council seats in our area next May, or who's our mayoral candidate going to be, or when are we going to select a parliamentary candidate, what petitions are we doing around the town, are we going to have a street stall out on Saturday morning, all of that meat and drink, you know, should happen. It's vital for any political party, but it's not sufficient, and it's particularly not sufficient for Reform, a new party, a startup, because it hasn't got a back catalogue of worked out policies to fall back on, or experience of what worked when we last had a Reform government and what didn't. So it's got the kind of attraction of a blank sheet of paper, but that means that there are going to have to be many more quills and many more pens put to work to, if you like, catch up the legacy parties in terms of what an actual Reform manifesto and action plan would look like. Colossal piece of work. There is time to do it. Seems to me that the leading lights of Reform are aware it needs to be done. And it's getting underway, and you know, I will watch and perhaps even contribute with great, great interest. It's potentially the most interesting kind of policy conundrum for somebody like me who's been around think tanks for 15 years or more. That, you know, getting that bit right and crafting the policy now and thinking out of the box, but also making sure that radical ideas can be grounded and can actually be implemented. Huge, huge, huge task. Probably won't make a massive impact on Reform's electoral prospects, although I think having some semblance of a plan in your top pocket is always a good idea for anyone wishing to aspire to be a government, but is absolutely vital for, you know, the day after polling day. It's absolutely vital that everybody knows which way's up if a government led by Reform is formed. So, yeah, big task. Get on with it. Wish you well with it.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, I think it's become clear now that whether it's 2029 or whenever it is, we're going to get one shot at this. That'll be one shot. And if we were to take power without the plan and to mess up badly, I don't know where the country goes from there. It would just be disastrous. So it's so important that we do have the whole thing fully mapped out and worked through. You'll be, I presume, going to another conference next week. What do you expect to find there?
The Conservatives, of which I remain a member, are at an unbelievably low ebb. I'm expecting morale to be low. There is not that I've detected any enormous sense of sedition at this stage. I don't think there is an enormous movement to replace the leader of the party, for example. That seems to be
you've got that out of your system last year, didn't you?
Yes, well, that's right. I mean, it does tend to be an annual event for the Conservative Party, you know, the annual leadership election. My observation of what's happened since the general election, where, you know, the Conservatives hit what many people would have thought, probably myself included, was rock bottom, 24% of the vote across the country. It turns out that wasn't the floor of support. That support is now measurably lower than that. I think if you take an average of the polls, Tories probably lost another third of that 24%, probably averaging, I don't know what, 16% or so in the polls. And that's existential. The Conservative Party is not part of the national discussion at the moment. Kemi will occasionally manage to get herself onto the front page of a sympathetic newspaper. I think on the day we're speaking today, she's managed to grab the front page of the Daily Express with her plan about how to fix Britain. But my fear is, if one were to look from a Conservative Party perspective, and I should say, you know, I'm basically roughly indifferent about what precise electoral vehicle saves the country from oblivion, whether it's Conservative reform, some mix, some merger, or something completely different. I don't much mind. I'm interested in which one it is, but I don't, you know, I'm not loyal to political parties in the same way that I'm loyal to my football club, who I will support through thick and thin, come what may.
Southampton, is it?
Southampton, yeah. So if Southampton go down to the Beezer Home League's Division 9, I will still be a season ticket holder at Southampton. But if the Conservative Party collapses to a dozen seats in Parliament and 8% of the vote, I'm just not interested in it as a vehicle. And I think what the Tories have got wrong is that they're behaving like a think tank, not like a political party. So they're actually doing quite a lot of the work that I'm encouraging Reform UK to do. I think that whatever is unveiled about Britain's membership of the ECHR, or very likely, I think we'll hear the Tories' roadmap about how precisely to withdraw from it and from other conventions. And my guess is I'm going to quite like the sound of it. But I'm not sure the electorate are suddenly going to say, ah, yes, well, I've always been in favour of leaving the ECHR. I'll now go back to the Conservatives because I prefer their 100-page peer-reviewed research paper into it than the Reform Party press release. So I think what the Conservatives have got to worry about is, are they just going to end up being Nigel Farage's think tank? That the Reform can take a pick and mix of whatever comes out of Kemi Badenoch's various policy reviews. And if Kemi and her team have worked out exactly how to navigate one's way out of ECHR and parts of the Refugee Convention and the Convention on Modern Torture and slavery and all of the rest of it, well, nothing is preventing Reform from just saying, oh, thank you for working that out for us.
We'll do that.
That's exactly what we'll do. So my impression is that the Conservatives, by and large, have not realised the existential nature of the problem they face. And if you were writing a history book called The Death of the British Conservative Party 2020 to 2030, the first half of that book and the first half of that decade would be almost exactly what has transpired to date. That what's happened between 2020 and 2025 are quite a few strides into the valley of death. And pleased to sort of hold one's nerve, or it will all come good, or we just need to be patient and develop some policy, I think is deflection techniques. So it could be over for the Tory party, and it will certainly be over if the Tory party itself does not realise the scale of the predicament that it faces. It's almost as if it's got stage one cancer, but is treating that by taking Lemsip. Well, that won't cure your cancer. It might cure a headache, but it won't cure cancer. And if you don't treat the cancer, it gets worse and eventually it kills you. And at the moment, I don't think they have diagnosed the scale of their own illness sufficiently, and therefore are not applying serious enough medicine. They're sort of sitting there hoping, I think, rather than expecting, that Farage and Reform will somehow implode, and then people in their wisdom will return to the Tory standard. And I think that's a forlorn hope. And in any event, it's a prayer rather than a strategy.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it was interesting that at the Labour conference this week, the Conservatives were notable by the complete absence of anybody even mentioning them. That's almost even worse in politics than being attacked, isn't it, if you're ignored?
I think that is right. And although I think actually Labour has made a major comms error in making Nigel Farage the centrepiece of their own conference, I mean, Nigel and the Reform press office must be punching the air with delight about the amount of coverage that they've received from this. And I think it has backfired on Labour. We'll wait to see the next round of polls. They are at least right that the Conservative Party is for now an irrelevance. It is the parliamentary opposition. So in Parliament, they will be more concerned about what Conservatives are likely to say, because it's the Conservatives, not Reform, who are at the dispatch box and who are more numerous than Reform on the floor of the House of Commons, and therefore more numerous in select committees and all of that sort of stuff. So the parliamentary opposition to the government on a day-to-day basis, such as it is largely being provided by the Conservative Party. That's not to suggest that the Reform MPs are making a bad fist of it, just that they're not very numerous. But out in the country, I mean, it's starting to look like it's a Reform versus Labour battle, isn't it? Or perhaps even Labour are dying. I mean, one of the jokes I have with people when they sort of say, oh, we're in a multi-party system now, is to say, no, actually, we're in a two-party system. We're still in a two-party system. It's just the two parties are Reform and the Liberal Democrats rather than Labour and Conservative. Both of the two main parties are falling away. So the Conservatives' big problem is they are being ignored, and they shouldn't accept that sitting down, if you know what I mean. There's no easy solution to that, but they've got to channel some of the sort of things that Farage himself would have been doing when he was ignored, or when the Brexit Party or its predecessor parties were, you know, only polling a few points in the polls. You need to do things that catch attention, catch a public imagination, and are appealing to the next slice of voters that you're hoping to pull over to your side of the ledger. But I haven't seen much of that, and I don't think that that is a strategic insight shared by the leadership of the Conservative Party at the moment, who seem to think that if you get enough detailed policies right enough, then the Tories will be forgiven for that they're showing in office, particularly the last couple of years of it, and people will naturally swing back. But I think politics is no longer in the predictable swinging pendulum phase that we would have been used to for most of our lives. Quite the opposite. It's fragmented. It's changed. We're experiencing quite a big realignment. And the Tories have... Sometimes Tory MPs are fond of saying, well, we have no right to exist. And I don't like that expression. They do have a right to exist. Every political party has a right to exist. There are, I think, more than 400 political parties registered with the Electoral Commission. They all have a right to exist. But you don't have a right to be taken seriously, and you don't have a right to expect to win. And the Conservatives, I think, are failing really on both those counts at the moment.
Well, I don't know if it'll be any comfort to you, but my impression, more locally actually than nationally, is that although the Conservatives are clearly at a very low ebb, and I mean, I've never been a Conservative, so it's of no interest to me, but I do think that the membership seem to be stickier than you might have expected. In other words, that, you know, it's people I've spoken to locally saying, you know, reform. I'm a Conservative. I've always been a Conservative. And I suppose this must be something that, you know, a 100-year-old party gives you. It's kind of hard to give up.
Yeah.
And that seems to be
the case.
Oh,
I'm sure that's right. I mean, the Conservative Party will not cease to exist. It will continue to exist. It will continue to fight elections. So there's no doubt about that. The question is if what befalls it is a bit like the fall of the Liberal Party about 100 years ago, that it moves to having a relatively small handful of seats that might be of interest if there is the arithmetical fluke of a hung parliament, but it retreats to its last remaining heartlands. In the case of the Liberal Party, that was basically the Celtic fringes.
Yep.
In the case of the Conservative Party, I guess it would probably be the leafy shires to the west of London, the Berkshires, the Surreys, perhaps North Hampshire, that sort of area. But you're right, you know, but there are people who have been, you know, there are lots of people who have been members of the Tory party for more than half a century. No one has been member of the Reform Party for more than a few years because it didn't exist more than a few years ago. And that does bring with it a certain stability and a certain continuity. And, you know, defecting from a party that you've been involved in your whole adult lifetime, or most of
especially,
it, is a bigger move.
Especially when you met that your wife or husband there.
Exactly, exactly that. So, you know, it is potentially a very strong social network. It's not just a question of electoral tactics or even ideology. For the 130,000 Conservatives that are left, a good number of them, you know, this is their meat and drink, this is their social network, this is how they've met their spouse, a good number of their friends, and turning their back on that would be a very, very big step. So yeah, the Conservative Party will not, when I actually say that the issue is existential, I don't actually think the Conservative Party will ever cease to exist. Just the question is, which goes back to your point about being ignored by the Labour government, whether it starts to exist in much the same way that the sort of Liberal Democrats or the Greens do, that you expect them to be there. You typically find them on the ballot paper, but you don't really credit them with a snowball in hell's chance of winning. And that's essentially what happened to the Liberal Party 100 years ago. It's not a certainty that will happen to the Conservative Party, far from a certainty. But it is the trajectory that the Tory Party is on at the moment, that it will be a party of 10, 12, 15, 18% of the vote, and wholly incapable of aspiring to win a general election in its own terms. That's the spot price at the moment. A lot can change. Politics is fluid. The future is unpredictable. But as I say, I think if the Conservatives don't realise the scale of their plight, they're unable to be, it's unlikely they'll be able to dig themselves out of the hole they now find themselves in.
And do you think this sort of thing whereby it's almost the social network of conservatism that's holding the thing together in any way at all, do you think that extends as far as the members of parliament? Because although we've had some interesting defections from the Tory party, there are a number of people still, I'm thinking people like David Frost and Jacob Rees-Mogg and one or two others, who you must think if they're looking at it from a purely rational point of view, they should be jumping ship now, because you know the window for reform won't stay open forever, and so therefore, you know, why are they still sticking?
Well, I mean, I think a lot of it is, I think for any conservative who's pondering it, it's clearly only a move you can make once.
Right?
Yes, changing political parties. Changing political parties is not like trading shares between Coca-Cola and Pepsi-Cola that you can switch back and forth every day if you want, or moving your money from sterling into dollars or vice versa. So if you make that move, you make it basically once. And you are definitely deserting a lot of people that you've gone shoulder to shoulder into the jungle with. You're turning those people not just, you know, potentially into enemies rather than being close friends. And look, I can't speak for either Jacob or David, although I know them both and admire them both. I don't know what exactly would be going through their minds, but I could surmise that there's also on the other side of the ledger, even if I'm despairing about the Conservatives, do I think reform is up to it? Or are there a whole load of question marks when it comes to reform? You know, is it really able to form a government? Is it serious enough about policy thinking? Is it just riding a bit of a wave at the moment because you've got the unusual circumstances of both Conservative and Labour being popular? And will it, you know, go back down to 15 or 20% of the vote? Those will be all the questions that I think would typically cross the mind of someone who might be considering moving from the Conservatives to reform. And you probably want there to be a very definitive, long-term, proven yes to all of those before you make the jump, because it's a one-shot game, as I say.
Yeah, okay. I do see that, but it still mystifies me sometimes when I look at it. Because, I mean, you say, okay, you know, they're not sure if reform have got the capability, the intellectual capacity, the experience and so on. But that's what these people could give us.
And, yeah, you know, I think
if they're serious about saving their country, surely they should be moving.
Yeah, I think that there's a compelling argument for that, isn't there? And, you know, although people would say it's bandwagon jumping, I mean, the mere fact that reform is at whatever it's at, 30, 32% in the polls and the Conservatives are at 17% would simply indicate that, you know, well, if that's the way that the cookie's going to crumble, you know, why not get onto the right side of that? I mean, I think there's also an issue for reform here about what approach they would like to take to those who are in the Conservative Party, but certainly sympathetic to reform's platform. I mean, it does strike me at the moment, and not a problem that Nigel Farage needs to address this week or this month, but it's difficult to sketch out what a Reform UK cabinet would look like at the moment, right? I mean, you presume that Farage is obviously going to be Prime Minister. Tice, Chancellor of the Exchequer, I suppose. And after that, I've run out of names. Who's the transport secretary going to be? Who's the health secretary going to be? Who's the education secretary going to be? Who's the DCMS secretary going to be? Who's the environment secretary going to be? Who's going to be the junior minister for aviation in the transport department? Who would be the head of the reform contingent in the House of Lords, if there is one? So it goes on. So the bit that that reform are missing, and there's no easy way for them to magic this up, is if you imagine that kind of what you need to win an election and form a government is a kind of pyramid structure. So you need a credible person right at the top of the pyramid who's your leader and prime minister. Well, I guess Nigel Farage quite comfortably ticks that box. At the kind of bottom of the pyramid, you need 250,000 members and loads of people knocking on doors and branch chairman organising events. And just above that, you've got a whole squadron of local councillors. And then just above that, you need to field 650 candidates or whatever it is in a general election. But the bit that's missing and is quite hard to build from scratch, because if you've got Farage and you've built the rest of it, is, you know, who are the 100 people who are going to be cabinet ministers or junior ministers in a reform government? And it seems to me objectively that if I was reform, I'd be looking at quite a few conservatives thinking, well, that conservative could clearly be a cabinet minister in a reform government or a junior minister or play some big role. And I'd be trying to poach those. And I'm not quite sure what reform's rules are about who they want to defect from the Conservative Party and who they don't.
We have, I believe, a defection team. So when somebody applies to defect, but we look at them and we examine their voting record, their background, and we look at it from the point of view of whether or not they're trying to join in order for their own purposes or in order to help reform in the country. And if the answer is the latter, then we accept them. If the answer is the former, then probably we don't.
No, yeah, I mean, I would almost, I think, encourage it just to be a bit more public than that. I mean, I can understand you want to vet people as well. You want to make sure that they're not up to their necks in anything untoward. That seems fair enough, but is a non-ideological point. But, you know, is it okay? I presume it is, because Jake Berry has joined Reform, to have been in favour of Remain in the 2016 referendum.
Well, I have to say, Jake Berry was one that did cause a bit of consternation among members generally, because you looked at his voting record, it wasn't impeccable by any means, and I was a bit queasy about him, I have to say. But having said that, I've now seen him a couple of times on podcasts and interviews and so on, and he says, "I've changed my mind. I no longer believe that." And people have to be allowed the opportunity to change their minds if they want to.
Yeah, no, I agree with all of that. I just think that my advice to reform would be to set it out in clearer terms. I'm not suggesting that reform shouldn't let in people who voted Remain. I mean, Charlie Mullins, who's a big drumbeat for reform now, I would have thought it would be better just to have a public checklist that, you know, you need to fulfill all six of these criteria, or you need to fulfill eight of these 10 criteria, quite apart from any like personal vetting about people's business affairs or you know, previous criminal history or whatever, because that's a bit messy at the moment, you know. And then I hear some people saying, oh, we couldn't possibly have this person because of their specific record in government about such and such. Well, you know, Jake Berry, who I'm fond of, I don't know at all well, but I would consider to be a good recruit to reform, actually. But, you know, if he gets in, it's not obvious to me that there's very many Conservative MPs who would not qualify.
Well, I mean, again, the recent defections, the other one that's caused a fair bit of consternation was Nadine Dorries, who had just finished writing the Digital Act. And, you know, so that wasn't particularly popular. But having said that, I think we have to allow the membership a bit of leeway, because, as you say, we do need people with cabinet experience and so on. So, and this comes to the crucial, when you're looking at selecting candidates for government from the branches. And I think the branches do have to cut the leadership a bit of slack so that they can say, you know, all right, we don't want, you know, umpteen Tories parachuted into seats all around the country. But if you're saying that we need this person, Danny Kruger's an MP anyway, didn't, but if you came along with somebody like Danny Kruger and said, we need this person because we need him to be Environment Secretary or whatever it is, so therefore, if that's the reason we're pulling rank and we're going to, he's going to be put forward for a safe seat, I don't think the membership would object.
Yeah, well, you'd be a better judge of that than I would, I guess, Ken, but I would suspect no, they wouldn't. I mean, it's going to be fascinating, which I guess we'll see, what, from, say, the middle of 2026 onwards, how reform go about beginning to recruit parliamentary candidates. There's quite a lot of geographical issues to overcome. So one senior reformer put it to me that, you know, a very large base of reform talent, if you like, a good chunk of people who you might assume would make good reform MPs are living and working in London, but there aren't too many seats, at least in inner London, that you would put down as nailed on reform gains. Whereas if you were to look at, say, Lincolnshire, for sake of argument, you could potentially imagine every single seat falling to reform in Lincolnshire. So you've got quite a conundrum. I guess you're just going to get the balance right between whether you're trying to put up, you know, local candidates who know the local area, know the neck of the woods like the back of their hand, you know every pub landlord in town, have been members of the local Rotary Club for 25 years, members of the Royal British Legion, have had their kids going to school there, etc. Or whether you try and pluck off some seats that are presumably those. I mean, it seems a bit ridiculous to talk about safe reform seats because there are only five at the moment. But theoretically, you could probably at the moment look at 50 or 100 seats in the country that you could probably say, look, you know, these are very likely to fall our way. And we really want, I don't know, you know, Matt Goodwin, for sake of argument, to get into Parliament. And therefore, we're going to give him a seat where he is very likely to prevail, even if he's not a local person. Yeah. Getting that balance right and making sure that the reform leadership and the grassroots are simpatico, or if you like, agree with your approach that there might be instances where the leadership needs to get its own way, seems to me an important thing to get right in 2026, because you need a mixture of people who really do understand and represent their local areas. But if you are aspiring to win the election, you know, something north of 100 people are going to have to be appointed to ministerial office within 2 days of that election.
Yeah, okay, but and I hear all that. The only thing I would say is that I'm perhaps, again, a little bit ahead of this, because I see the quality of the people on the ground that are coming for reform. We in the world, we've got 50 odd. Councillors selected so far, and I look at half of them, and all, you know, many of these could easily be general election candidates, and frankly, they would do a better job because they're not PPE at Oxford and worked in as a spad for 5 years. They are real people with real world experience and talent, and so we need to make sure that we don't shut them out, that we allow them a route to move forward.
For sure, that's got to be the bulk of the slate. There's no doubt about it. But let me just try and mount a bit of a rearguard defence for people who have read PPE at Balliol College, Oxford, which includes me. I am someone who did PPE at Balliol College, Oxford. I've never been a fad, but let me just do an attempted sort of rearguard defense for some of these establishment types. This is all good and grand, and I think should be probably the bulk of the slate that reform puts forward to the electorate. But you don't just need to have someone who says, you know, I've run a successful local business in the Wirral and I know which way's up and I know what it's like to hire people and fire people and I know how bad it is to deal with red tape and I know how taxes can, you know, nearly kill off a business. I've got all of that real world experience. Yeah, by God, we need that because Parliament hasn't got enough of that real world experience.
Hasn't got any.
Exactly. I mean, I think that if you look at the cabinet, if you discount the legal profession, there's no one with any private sector experience in the cabinet. It's quite extraordinary. But you also need people who know whether or not early day motions in the House of Commons are a waste of time or a good use of time. That how you pilot a bill through committee stage. How you whip people in order to make sure a bill doesn't fall at second reading. What is the optimal way to intervene in debates in support or opposition to the government of the day? All of that is the sort of stuff that the PPEists who have been spads for 20 years know inside out and back to front. And folk who have done a very good job in the real world don't know how to do that inside out and back to front. And you need an appropriate mix of that. If the next parliament is Nigel Farage, plus 350 Reform MPs who've all done a jolly good job at running their local business and have, you know, done well for themselves and know their local area, that won't be sufficient to form a credible government, in my view, even though we need a large chunk of people who fit exactly that profile. It cannot be 99.9% of the Reform Parliamentary Party. It just would not be a government that functioned. It would not know how to navigate its way around Whitehall or Westminster. And it needs some of that canny, inside the beltway know-how, frankly, because piloting stuff through Westminster and the parliamentary system and the Whitehall system and the civil service bureaucracy, that's not something that comes naturally, because it's a very weird, broken, stupid system. But you do need to be able to navigate it. And I'm not totally persuaded that there's any amount of sort of local business expertise that prepares you for that. Obviously, the application of basic common sense and intelligence is a useful thing, but that's a prerequisite. Some particular knowledge. I mean, I can remember looking back to just after the general election, and this might sound like a rather prosaic or trivial point, but when Reform got five MPs in, and Farage and the others did a sort of video, but it was them sort of the other four turning up outside sort of saying, well, thank God we've got Lee Anderson, because he can sort of show us around and tell us where the toilets are and where we're supposed to put our bags. And it was Farage saying this in a fairly, you know, which seats are we supposed to sit on? What's it mean that prayers are just before the opening of Parliament? Do I have to be there for prayers? Do I not have to be there for prayers? Supposing I sit in the wrong seat? And all of that, you know, is that kind of first day at university thing. You're going to need some people who are in their second or third year at university if you really want it to work properly and sensibly. But that's, I'm in no means suggesting that one should be resistant to a breath of fresh air in Parliament. I think people are crying out for that. But it can't be, in my view, the totality of it if you're serious about forming a government that can navigate its way around London SW1.
But on the other hand, if we were successful and in power, these people would not be difficult to recruit, because there would be plenty of ex-Tory spads and ex-Labour spads, for that matter, sitting around looking for the right opportunities. So we should be able to recruit those fairly easily, you would have thought.
Yes. I mean, you know, the rough scale of the recruitment exercise, and look, we're jumping, you know, nine steps down the track, because, you know, we're sort of, for the sake of this thought experiment, assuming a Reform majority. But let's just stick with that thought experiment. Let's take that as a premise. You know, the rough scale of what you're going to need in terms of personnel is one person to be Prime Minister. Well, you seem to have that. At least 20 people who are capable of being Cabinet Ministers immediately on day one. I don't think you've got that 20 yet. An additional 330 people who are capable of being good parliamentarians from day one, I'm assuming, you know, 350 Reform MPs, who are, you know, able to loyally support the government on the floor of the House of Commons, but are basically quite good at spreading the message, preferably quite good on the national media, could be the Reform backbench spokesman on any questions or Question Time or Newsnight or the Daily Politics or the World at One, etc., and know how to spread the local media message. You need 300 people of that ilk. You potentially need a further 500 if you're going to flood the House of Lords rather than reform the House of Lords. And in terms of the bureaucracy, you probably need, including senior civil servants, you know, who are difficult to shift, about 3,000 people who, you know, from, you know, advisors on flood defences to people who are experts on how the bus network across the UK works, to people who know which pesticides have been banned in farming and which haven't, 3,000. So, and, you know, these people basically are all at one level or another need to be experts, you know, need to be highly talented. Not the MPs probably can be a bit generalist, but the chief advisor to the environment secretary on which pesticides can and can't be used in the UK. I mean, that's a pretty expert piece of policy knowledge, and you need about 3,000 such people. So you're right, there'll be some Labour and Conservative spads, you know, who will, having been issued their P45, will be interested in employment. But that's the sort of scale of personnel you're going to need to run a government. Yeah. And I think Reform are short in quite a substantial number of ways. There's time to make that up, but
it's there's a couple of years to go yet, isn't there? So we've got some time, and that's always what I console myself with.
Yeah.
Could we just move maybe away from party politics a little bit, and because your expertise obviously is in economics, isn't it? I was a bit taken aback when we spoke briefly at the conference, and I said to you, can you tell me, Mark, which month of this year or next will the crash come?
Yeah.
And you said, I don't think there'll be a crash. I think there'll just be a general deterioration of the state of things until such time as, it just gets worse and worse. And that was very depressing to me.
Sorry about that. Economics is known as the dismal science. Yeah.
But I was looking at, I had another look at the figures. And when you look at the figures and starkly, with £3 trillion worth of debt, we have £112 billion worth of interest that we're paying each year on that debt. With gilts gone up in the last 3 years from 1% to 5.5% 30-year gilts, we're in a terrible state. We can't carry on. You say it was just going to get worse and worse month after month. I can't see that can happen.
Well, you might be right. And, it's the nature of, if you like, one-off apocalyptic economic inflection points is that they're rarely spotted in advance, right? There was virtually no one who said a week before the banking crash, guess what? There's going to be a banking crash. There was virtually no one at the time.
It was pointless me asking you.
I think it's. I think anyone who says, I think if anyone had answered your question by saying, well, actually, the answer is March the 16th, 2027, that is when the economic crash is going to happen. Take that with several buckets of salt, right? Because most economic forecasts are worthless, really. They're guesstimates. So I don't think there's. My point in my answer to you, Ken, at Reform Conference, was that. I don't think I can put a particular month in which we suddenly run out of money. It doesn't quite happen that way. I mean, a number of things could occur, which I think would count as an economic crash. It could be that there's a run on sterling and sterling collapses and therefore inflation goes through the roof. And therefore interest rates have to go through the roof and therefore gilts will go through the roof. And you get a kind of perfect storm that makes plodding along in the rather unedifying fashion we are just impossible within 24 hours. That a massive change of direction needs to be had, that the government would need to, I don't know, sake of argument, suddenly cut public expenditure by 25% or something like that, just to balance the books. That's possible. That might be combined with calling in the IMF. For example, although I don't think the IMF now has it doesn't have the resources to bail out Britain. So we're in many ways in a worse position than we were in the 1970s. I don't rule out that you could get something akin to the winter of discontent, that there's some sort of general strike, or when I say general strike, the public sector go on strike because the Labour government have to say, sorry, there's no more money for pay rises. And they say, well, we were hoping for 15 or 20%. So the country kind of grinds to a halt. I mean, oddly enough, in the short run, strikes save you money because you don't need to pay wages. Obviously, they're very bad for economic growth. But what I expect to happen, my medium point prediction, it's with no certainties attached, is we will have 2 or 3 or 4 years of things getting marginally worse each year, that public services will continue to decay. The interest we have to pay on servicing our debt will continue to nudge up. Economic growth will be near as damn it zero, but we won't necessarily get a colossal recession. It will just plod along at 0.1%, 0.2% a year growth, nothing like enough to keep up with the debts and the liabilities that we're accruing. And yes, there's an awful lot of ruin in a nation, as Adam Smith says, that you can actually continue along a pathway of doing unsustainable and stupid things for quite a long period of time. And sadly, my midpoint prediction is that's what will occur. I say sadly, I mean, it might be for the best of the country. Sometimes people want there to be a kind of day of destiny in which it's completely plain that things need to change because X has just happened.
Some kind of a reset.
Yes, well, I mean, I think that you can have. I mean, I think a reset is coming, right? Because over the long run, our economic and fiscal position is unsustainable. And a feature of unsustainable positions is they're not sustained. They can't be sustained forever. It is impossible to sustain the present borrowing and expenditure by the UK government. It is impossible. We cannot raise enough tax to pay for all of the things that the government apparently wants to spend money on, let alone to begin to lower our liabilities. I mean, you've mentioned the $3 trillion and what we're doing on servicing the on-balance sheet debt, but we have accrued colossal liabilities that are not even on the balance sheet. Yeah. Public sector pensions, for example. You know, we're going to have to some magic up some way of finding trillions of pounds if we're going to honour these, or are we going to dishonour them? Are we actually going to say to people in the public sector, well, you might have been planning on retiring next week, but bad news, your pension's only going to be half of what we told you it was. Colossal issues here. So a reset is coming. I just think it might happen in virtue of people getting sick to the back teeth with things gradually getting worse, with GDP per capita typically falling, with there being no evidence that Labour has a plan to in any way turn things around. They're based on the power of prayer. And that you get some reset because a new government says it can't be like this anymore. We're going to have to level with you about how bad the public finances are. And, you know, we're going to have to. I mean, I get sick and tired of politicians saying what difficult choices they take. They don't take any difficult choices at all. I mean, the real difficult choices in our in government spending is, you know, where are you going to find something like 100 to 200, maybe 250 billion pounds worth of savings? That's the sort of scale of savings that's required to make things sustainable. And not many people are willing to talk about that, other than sort of saying, oh, well, we're making a very difficult decision to, you know, save 300 million here or 300 million there. It's like worrying about, it's like having a £10 note behind your sofa and worrying that your house is burning down and you're going to lose the £10 note. You know, we're in a way, way worse position than. So all of these arguments about the triple lock pension, the winter fuel allowance, all of these sort of things, you can have an argument one way or another, but they are actually rounding errors within the overall fiscal situation that the UK finds itself in. And someone has got to find a way just to balance the books of reducing expenditure by 100 billion a year. That still involves us having a long-term unsustainable position, but at least it would balance things in the short or medium term. And I hope reform come up with some list like that. Kemi Badenoch, in fairness, is saying that she at some point is going to be upfront and honest with the British people about what needs to change, but it will need to change. It's not sustainable. But the mere fact that our trajectory is not sustainable does not mean that there is definitely going to be a crunch point this year, next year, or the year after. Mm. We can carry on an unsustainable path, unfortunately, for a good while before reality smacks us in the face. It will do at some point. And it might do so quite quickly. I'm not ruling that out. But my answer to you at the time was actually, I think, still the most likely thing. And you're right, Ken, it's quite a depressing thing, is that gradually things just get worse and worse and worse and more dire incrementally, 1 week, 1 month, 1 year at a time, without there actually being something as dramatic as a banking collapse or a sterling crisis. I'm not ruling those out. I'm just saying that it's not a certainty we get them this side of the election.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you can't rule out the fact that it won't come to politicians to say we're going to have to take away your pensions because we can't afford to pay them. I mean, the logic of the market is that there just won't be any money to pay it with. That, yep. you'll go to your bank account and the money won't be there. Do you see a central bank digital currency having any kind of role in this reset?
Well, I'm against a central bank digital currency. Sure, yeah. I mean, I suppose in an ideal, you know, let's think completely outside the box kind of way, I'm against central banks, right? I mean, I don't think that the record of the banking authorities in running our currency has been a particularly impressive one. And I'm quite interested, although sometimes it can take you down a rabbit hole, about how quickly people will move their assets, say, out of sterling and into crypto. And, you know, we'll all have Bitcoin accounts that people can't access. And if you like, fiat currency, state issued currency starts to become a bit of an irrelevance, that we'd all need to hold a bit of it because it's how you transact each day. But you wouldn't really have your savings in sterling. You'd have your savings. I mean, increasingly happens now. People have their savings in equities. We just measure it in savings. So I don't know on a central bank digital currency. I fear it. Not so much for financial or monetarist reasons, but as much for state control reasons. I think you're two steps away from social credit being a system then that the government, you know, a mixture of digital ID cards, central bank digital currencies, and, you know, you've opened the doorway to, if you haven't done your daily exercise, you don't get your, you know, you don't get your pay. You know, if you haven't finished your vegetables, you don't get your payment. I mean, I'm exaggerating for effect, but you're opening the floodgates to that sort of relationship between state power and individual citizens, which I would like us to resist.
Yeah, I'm with you entirely. It was interesting that Starmer raised the digital ID card just a few days before the Labour conference, and I'm not sure that was very smart either.
I'm smart. I mean, and completely. I mean, I was very involved in the campaign to stop ID cards about 20 years ago. I set up No to ID, and I always put this prominently on my CV because it's a very rare example of a campaign I was involved in that was successful. It defeated ID cards, but we're going to have to do all of that again. Nobody's yet explained to me in any remotely coherent way what the problem is that digital ID cards would solve, or why they are the principal solution to the problem. We need to improve the present ID systems that we have, but our problem's not with regard to, let's say, asylum hotels or illegal working, that border force are storming into an asylum hotel and can't distinguish between who's supposed to be here and who isn't, or that some employer can't distinguish between whether they're employing dodgy labor or legitimate labor. So you've just got to make if you can't make the national insurance card system, the national health service number system robust, what chance has the state got of making a national identity register robust? Virtually zero, I would argue.
Okay, well, look, I've enjoyed the chat. Thanks very much indeed for your time. I've got one final thought experiment for you before you go. You've joined the Labour Party and you've been promoted rapidly, and you find yourself in the Chancellor of the Exchequer about to do a budget in November. Mm-hmm. Is there anything that you can do that would turn things around to get some growth?
Yeah, I mean, I think that growth is probably one further step away. The first thing you've got to do is to show some fiscal responsibility, right? Because that will then put you in a position in which you can potentially go for growth. So I would still, if I was in that unenviable position of suddenly replacing Rachel Reeves tomorrow, I would still be vigorously looking at any areas of government expenditure that can be reduced, preferably rather uncontroversial ones. You know, they decided to go for welfare reductions and this caused a big political backlash, whatever you think of the sense of those policies or not. So I would definitely be looking to try and find a number of billions of pounds in savings. And you might need to do some tough stuff on pay provisions or a freeze on civil service hiring, that sort of thing. Try and bank as much as you can without your backbenchers becoming a complete rabble against you. The other thing, which I'm disappointed with the Labour government from top to toe. Unsurprisingly, I didn't expect I'd like anything of what it was going to do. But there were a couple of areas where I actually wondered whether Labour might have the bravery, the political acumen, and the ideological drive to go for a few areas that the Conservatives didn't. And I'd say that's especially around planning reform, that it is nearly impossible to build anything in Britain. It is ludicrous, and not just housing, sort of any infrastructure projects. I mean, I don't know if Heathrow Airport ever will be expanded, but if I do see it in my lifetime, I will only see it at the tail end of my lifetime, being a very old man. This is absolutely absurd. And so if you really do want to get things moving, whether certainly around planning, but in other areas too, you could substantially deregulate would be something that I would encourage the Chancellor of the Exchequer to look at. I certainly would look at that. And deregulation doesn't get you growth immediately. If we relax and liberalize our planning laws and make it much easier to build houses and factories and cinemas and casinos and airports and railway stations, you won't suddenly get the benefit of that within a week, but you will within a year or so. And oftentimes, I think that we look at the growth equation just being in terms of tax and spend, and a lot of it is that. Taxes going up are generally bad for growth because the private sector is more efficient at allocating resources than the public sector. So if we could reduce taxes, that would help. But if you're going to take the present public sector spending envelope more or less as a given, it's quite difficult to lower taxes meaningfully. You might want to sort out and simplify them. So go for some deregulation, certainly around planning, maybe around financial services as well, where we've basically sought to remove risk from our financial services industry, which is ludicrous because the financial services industry is entirely predicated on the handling of risk. If there is no risk, you don't need a financial services industry. I start to explore some of those, but planning, relaxing planning and allowing building as a default, which probably means running a coach and horses through the Town and Country Planning Act of 1947, was it? That might just give you some growth. I think even if I was in that unenviable, horrible situation of being parachuted into number 11 Downing Street now and making the best of it, the sort of fist that I could make of it would be pretty marginal. It might stop things getting worse, but I don't think it would do a great deal to make things enormously better, in large part because of the ideological restrictions that the Labour MPs will place around any of the medicine that I think you and I know Britain needs to swallow. But the Labour Party is completely unwilling to deliver.
Yeah. I mean, do you think there's any possibility that you could do something? Because what you've said is fine and, you know, all good things, but it's not going to get any growth next year, is it? You know, relaxing planning. So is there anything that you could do suddenly? For example, and it's something that actually Rachel Reeves might have a better chance of doing than you, but could you take the kind of reforms that Liz Truss was talking about doing when she was briefly in power? And so you look at the sort of reverse Laffer curve where you cut tax rates in order to get more taxation. And and how do you think the bond markets would look if you tried to do that?
Yeah, I mean, sort of once bitten, twice shy after the Truss episode, right? Although I think that the crash was more down to the behaviour of the Bank of England than it was to do with Kwarteng and Truss's mini budget. You could do that you could deploy Laffer curve arguments. And actually, I wish that Liz had done so at the time of her mini budget with the controversial step of reducing the top rate of income tax from 45 to 40p. I think that you could do that and say, we're going to do this for a year and then we're going to look at what revenue has come in. And if the revenue that's come in is way below expectations, well, maybe 45p was the peak of the Laffer curve and we've gone too far down the other side. If, however, money starts pouring in and we're clawing in more from high earners, we might yet go further and cut the top rates down to 38p, 37p, 36p. I know Art Laffer himself thinks on income, anything over 38% is almost certainly on the wrong side of the Laffer curve. So you could do that for the top rate of tax. You could certainly do that for corporation tax, right? That you could say on corporation tax, which is a politically popular tax because it appears to be a tax on profits of big companies. Of course, you know, you can't, in the real world, the only thing you can tax is human beings, right? So if you're taxing a company, it's all being passed down to the shareholders or people who've got their pension invested in it, all the workers, all the customers. But it does seem that our corporation tax going up has been alongside corporation tax receipts being highly disappointing. But could Rachel Reeves really stand up in front of those with those 400 or so Labour MPs behind her and say, my great recipe for growth is for the next 2 years, I'm going to cut corporation tax from 15% from its present level. And I'm going to hope that that both brings in me a similar level of revenue, but also encourages entrepreneurialism. She could stand up and say that, and she would probably be right, in my view. It would be a bold move, but not a reckless move. But she ain't going to stand up and say it because the Labour Party won't let her do so. And
you,
I think
you were impersonating her in the thought bubble, so I thought you might.
So, I mean, I think one of the reasons, look, I don't know, I I've only met her twice in my life, I think. But I think one of the reasons that she is looking so distressed at the moment, I have no idea what might be going on in her personal life, but one of the reasons that her job might be making her so utterly distressed is she is in an impossible position. I think she is actually smart enough and bright enough to know the sort of steps that need to be taken to keep the show on the road. But she is also being made acutely aware that taking any of those steps appears to be politically impossible. Absolutely. And that is a nightmare position. She knows that she cannot deliver anything like the necessary surgery to help rehabilitate the patient. So to that extent, on a human level, I have, I guess, a little bit of sympathy with her. But on a political level, I'm afraid the Labour Party won the election on the arrogant assumption that all that was really needed for the economy to turn around was to put the adults back in the room and to show that the shambolic Tories had been kicked onto the opposition benches. That was pretty much the totality of their economic strategy, that simply bringing in something that might look a bit more like stability would be the magic ingredient that would kickstart the economy. Ludicrous, arrogant and narcissistic sort of approach to economic policy. And therefore, I would say, fair warning, I hope Reform don't fall into the same trap, if indeed Reform form the next government. So rather than going into an election promising 106 things that you won't do, raise VAT, raise income tax rates, raise taxes on working people, put together a more bold, daring, honest, and slightly more difficult recipe of what you are going to do, and then I think you have some sort of chance. Because, you know, Rachel Reeves didn't have a mandate to withdraw the winter fuel allowance, right? That wasn't in the Labour Party manifesto. They weren't honest about it up front. They genuinely thought, well, if they didn't think what I've just surmised that they thought, that their mere presence as opposed to the Conservatives would be enough to kickstart the economy, which is grand narcissism. If they weren't that narcissistic, then they were deceitful, that they knew full well that there would have to be some sort of mixture of spending cuts and tax rises, but they were not willing to admit that and danced around like angels on the head of a pin, pretending that this doesn't count as a tax on working people, freezing the income tax thresholds and hoping nobody's going to notice for 7 years. And, you know, that might just about be a recipe for winning an election, but it's no recipe for running a government or being even anything approaching diligent when it comes to the economy. So I hope our next government doesn't run on a platform of nothingness and then find itself caught in a trap of not being able to do anything because it didn't even seek a mandate for it. That's really the lesson that we should learn from Labour's abysmal failure on the economy and its complete incoherence in working out where to go from here.
Good. Well, on that note, let me thank you once again for joining me on the podcast. I hope you've enjoyed it. I certainly have. And hopefully you may consider coming on again at some point in the future.
Great. Really, really enjoy the conversation. Keep up the good work. Look forward to seeing you in person again soon, Ken.
Thanks, Mark. Cheers.
Take care. Bye.